Welcome to the Stillwaters Revival Books, PuritanDownloads.com, reading number 5 of the book Family Reformation, The Legacy of Sola Scriptura in Calvin's Geneva by Pastor Scott Brown. This book is copyright 2009 by Merchant Adventures Incorporated and is read by permission. Stillwaters Revival Books makes a large number of Puritan and Reformed MP3s, books, videos, etc., available free of charge at PuritanDownloads.com. These free Reformation resources can be accessed through the free books links at PuritanDownloads.com. Scott Brown is a pastor, author, and conference speaker, and the director of the National Center for Family Integrated Churches, NCFIC.org. Now to SWRB's reading number 5. Of Family Reformation, The Legacy of Sola Scriptura in Calvin's Geneva by Pastor Scott Brown. We're in chapter 17, Honor and Obedience Toward Parents. No one can despise his father without being guilty of an offense against God. Calvin knew that dishonor in the heart of a child or disobedience in behavior would mean that earthly blessings would be cut off from them. He taught that in the family the name of father is sacred, and no one can despise his father without being guilty of an offense against God. He warned children of the dangers of disobedience, declaring that an inevitable curse threatens all stubborn and disobedient children. He noted how rare it is to find obedient children who honor their parents, asking, "For do we find one among a thousand that is obedient to his parents?" While parents are prone to exasperate their children and sin against them if they handle discipline in an ungodly manner, Calvin did not believe that this freed children from obedience to their parents. He declared that those who abusively or stubbornly violate parental authority are monsters, not men. And now Calvin speaks. Despising a father is despising God. We quote, "Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee." Exodus 20:12. It will be now well to ascertain what is the force of the word honor. Not as to its grammatical meaning, for kabod is nothing else but to pay due honor to God and to men who are in authority, but as to its essential signification. Surely, since God would not have his servants comply with external ceremonies only, it cannot be doubted but that all the duties of piety towards parents are here comprised, to which children are laid under obligation by natural reason itself. And these may be reduced to three heads, that is, that they should regard them with reverence, that they should obediently comply with their commands, and allow themselves to be governed by them, and that they should endeavor to repay what they owe to them, and thus heartily devote to them themselves and their services. Since, therefore, the name of Father is a sacred one, and is transferred to men by the peculiar goodness of God, the dishonoring of parents redounds to the dishonor of God himself. Nor can anyone despise his father without being guilty of an offense against God. Sacrilegium. If any should object that there are many ungodly and wicked fathers whom their children cannot regard with honor without destroying the distinction between good and evil, the reply is easy, that the perpetual law of nature is not subverted by the sins of men. And therefore, however unworthy of honor a father may be, that he still retains, inasmuch as he is a father, his right over his children, provided it does not in any wise derogate from the judgment of God. For it is too absurd to think of absolving, under any pretext, the sins which are condemned by his law. Nay, it would be a base profanation to misuse the name of father for the covering of sins. In condemning, therefore, the vices of a father, a truly pious son will subscribe to God's law, and still, whatsoever he may be, will acknowledge that he is to be honored as being the father given him by God. The third head of honor is that children should take care of their parents and be ready and diligent in all their duties toward them. This kind of piety the Greeks call antepelag, Gia, Pelargia, because storks supply food to their parents when they are feeble and worn out with old age, and are thus our instructors in gratitude. Hence the barbarity of those is all the more base and detestable, who either grudge or neglect to relieve the poverty of their parents, and to aid their necessities. End of quote. Obedience of children enforced by the authority of God. Quote, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee. Thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Ephesians 6, 1-4. Children, obey. Why does the apostle use the word obey instead of honor, which has a greater extent of meaning? It's because obedience is the evidence of that honor which children owe to their parents and is therefore more earnestly enforced. It is likewise more difficult, for the human mind recoils from the idea of subjection and with difficulty allows itself to be placed under the control of another. Experience shows how rare this virtue is, for do we find one among a thousand that is obedient to his parents? By a figure of speech, a part is here put for the whole, but it is the most important part, and is necessarily accompanied by all the others. In the Lord, and besides the law of nature, which is acknowledged by all nations, the obedience of children is enforced by the authority of God. Hence it follows that parents are to be obeyed, so far only as is consistent with piety to God, which comes first in order. If the command of God is the rule by which the submission of children is to be regulated, it would be foolish to suppose that the performance of this duty could lead away from God himself. For this is right. This is added in order to restrain the fierceness which, we have already said, appears to be natural to almost all men. He proves it to be right because God has commanded it, for we are not at liberty to dispute or call in question the appointment of him whose will is the unerring rule of goodness and righteousness. That honor should be represented as including obedience is not surprising, for mere ceremony is of no value in the sight of God. The precept, honor thy father and mother, comprehends all the duties by which the sincere affection and respect of children to their parents can be expressed. Which is the first commandment with promise. The promises annexed to the commandments are intended to excite our hopes and to impart a greater cheerfulness to our obedience, and therefore Paul uses this as a kind of seasoning to render the submission which he enjoins on children more pleasant and agreeable. He does not merely say that God has offered a reward to him who obeys his father and mother, but that such an offer is peculiar to this commandment. If each of the commandments had its own promises, there would have been no ground for the commendation bestowed in the present instance. But this is the first commandment, Paul tells us, which God has been pleased, as it were, to seal by a remarkable promise. There is some difficulty here, for the second commandment likewise contains a promise, I am the Lord thy God who show mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments, Exodus 20:5-6. But this is universal, applying indiscriminately to the whole law, and cannot be said to be annexed to that commandment. Paul's assertion still holds true, that no other commandment but that which enjoins the obedience due by children to their parents is distinguished by a promise. Submission, a step, oh, that was the end of quote, a step in our ascent to the supreme parent. We quote again now from John Calvin. But as this command to submit is very repugnant to the perversity of the human mind, which, puffed up with ambitious longings, will scarcely allow itself to be subject, that superiority which is most attractive and least invidious is set forth as an example calculated to soften and bend our minds to habits of submission. From that subjection which is most easily endured, the Lord gradually accustoms us to every kind of legitimate subjection, the same principle regulating all. For all, to those whom he raises to eminences, he communicates his authority. insofar as necessary to maintain their station. The titles of Father, God, and Lord all meet in Him alone, and hence, whenever any one of them is mentioned, our mind should be impressed with the same feeling of reverence. Those, therefore, to whom He imparts such titles, He distinguishes by some small spark of His refulgence, so as to entitle them to honor, each in his own place. In this way we must consider that our earthly Father possesses something of a divine nature in Him, because there is some reason for His bearing a divine title, and that He who is our Prince and Ruler is admitted to some communion of honor with God. And it makes no difference whether those on whom the honor is conferred are deserving or not. Be they what they may, the Almighty, by conferring their station upon them, shows that He would have them honored. The commandment specifies the reverence due to those to whom we owe our being. This nature herself should in some measure teach us, for they are monsters and not men, who petulantly and contumeliously violate the paternal authority. Hence the Lord orders all who rebel against their parents to be put to death, they being, as it were, unworthy of the light in paying no deference to those to whom they are indebted for beholding it. And it is evident, from the various appendices to the law, that we were correct in stating that the honor here referred to consists of three parts: reverence, obedience, and gratitude. The first of these the Lord enforces when He commands that who curseth his father or his mother shall be put to death. In this way He avenges insult and contempt. The second He enforces when He denounces the punishment of death on disobedient and rebellious children. And to the third belongs our Savior's declaration that God requires us to do good to our parents, Matthew 15. And whenever Paul mentions this commandment, he interprets it as enjoining obedience. A promise is added by way of recommendation, the better to remind us how pleasing to God is the submission which is here required. Paul applies that stimulus to rouse us from our lethargy when he calls this the first commandment with promise, the promise contained in the first table not being specially appropriated to any one commandment but extended to the whole law. Whence this promise has, in like manner, reference to us also, inasmuch as the duration of the present life is a proof of the divine benevolence toward us. Wherefore, if anyone who is obedient to parents happens to be cut off before mature age, a thing which not infrequently happens, the Lord nevertheless adheres to His promise as steadily as when He bestows 100 acres of land where He had promised only one. The whole lies in this. We must consider that long life is promised only in so far as it is a blessing from God, and that it is a blessing only in so far as it is a manifestation of divine favor. This, however, He testifies and truly manifests to His servants more richly and substantially by death. Therefore, the submission yielded to them should be a step in our ascent to the Supreme Parent, and hence, if they instigate us to transgress the law, they deserve not to be regarded as parents, but as strangers attempting to seduce us from obedience to our true Father. The same holds in the case of rulers, masters, and superiors of every description. For it were unbecoming and absurd that the honor of God should be impaired by their exaltation, an exaltation which, being derived from Him, ought to lead us up to Him. End of quote. Children, to be obedient in all things, what does all mean? We quote now John Calvin, "Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord," Colossians 3:20. He enjoins it upon children to obey their parents without any exception, but what if parents should feel disposed to constrain them to anything that is unlawful? Will they in that case too obey without any reservation? Now it were worse than unreasonable that the authority of men should prevail at the expense of neglecting God. I answer that here too we must understand as implied what he expresses elsewhere, Ephesians 6:1, in the Lord. But for what purpose does he employ a term of universality? I answer again that it is to show that obedience must be rendered not merely to just commands, but also such as are unreasonable. For many make themselves compliant with the wishes of their parents only where the command is not grievous or inconvenient. But on the other hand, this one thing ought to be considered by children, that whoever may be their parents, they have been allotted to them by the providence of God, who by his appointment makes children subject to their parents. In all things, therefore, that they may not refuse anything, however difficult or disagreeable, in all things, that in things indifferent they may give deference to the station which their parents occupy, in all things, that they may not put themselves on a footing of equality with their parents, in the way of questioning and debating or disputing, it being always understood that conscience is not to be infringed upon. He prohibits parents from exercising an immoderate harshness, lest their children should be so disheartened as to be incapable of receiving any honorable training. For we see, from daily experience, the advantage of a liberal education. End of quote. Long life, a gift of God in this present life. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. For this is right, honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Ephesians 6:1-4. That it may be well with thee, the promise is a long life, from which we are led to understand that the present life is not to be overlooked among the gifts of God. Those who show kindness to their parents from whom they derived life are assured by God that in this life it will be well with them. End of quote. Forbidden, detracting from the dignity of father and mother. Quote, the purpose is, since the maintenance of his economy pleases the Lord God, the degrees of preeminence established by him ought to be inviolable for us. This, then, is the sum. We should look up to those whom God has placed over us, and should treat them with honor, obedience, and gratefulness. It follows from this that we are forbidden to detract from their dignity either by contempt, by stubbornness, or by ungratefulness. End of quote. Those who violate parental authority are monsters. John Calvin. For this reason, we ought not to doubt that the Lord has here established a universal rule. That is, knowing that someone has been placed over us by the Lord's ordination, we should render to him reverence, obedience, and gratefulness, and should perform such other duties for him as we can. It makes no difference whether our superiors are worthy or unworthy of this honor. For whatever they are, they have attained their position through God's providence, a proof that the lawgiver himself would have us hold them in honor. However, he has expressly bidden us to reverence our parents who have brought us into this life. Nature itself ought in a way to teach us this. Those who abusively or stubbornly violate parental authority are monsters, not men. Hence the Lord commands that all those disobedient to their parents be put to death. For since they do not recognize those whose efforts brought them into the light of day, they are not worthy of its benefits. What we have noted is clearly true from various additions to the law, that there are three parts of the honor here spoken of, reverence, obedience, and gratefulness. The Lord confirms the first, reverence, when he enjoins that one who curses his father or mother be killed. Exodus 21:17, Leviticus 20:9, Proverbs 20:20. There he punishes contempt and abuse. He confirms the second, obedience, when he decrees the penalty of death for disobedient and rebellious children, Deuteronomy 21:18-21. What Christ says in Matthew 5 refers to the third kind of honor, gratefulness. It is of God's commandment that we do good to our parents, verses 4-6, and whenever Paul mentions this commandment, he interprets it as requiring obedience, Ephesians 6:1-3, Colossians 3:20. End of quote. Curses for disobedient children. Quote, Besides, while the Lord promises the blessing of the present life to those children who duly honor their parents, at the same time he implies that an inevitable curse threatens all stubborn and disobedient children. To assure that this commandment be carried out, he has, through his law, declared them subject to the sentence of death, and commanded that they undergo punishment. If they elude that judgment, he himself takes vengeance upon them in some way or other. For we see how many men of this sort perish either in battles or in quarrels. Others are cast down in ways less common. Nearly all offer proof that this threatening is not in vain. Some people may escape punishment until extreme old age, yet in this life they are bereft of God's blessing, and can only miserably pine away, being reserved for greater punishments to come. Far indeed, then, are they from sharing in the blessing promised to godly children. But we also ought in passing to note that we are bidden to obey our parents only, quote, in the Lord. End of quote. Punishment for striking father and mother. Again, John Calvin. For every one that curseth his father or his mother shall be surely put to death. He hath cursed his father or his mother. His blood shall be upon him, Leviticus 20:9. The commandment is now sanctioned by the denunciation of capital punishment for its violation, yet not so as to comprehend all who have in any respect sinned against their parents, but sufficient to show that the rights of parents are sacred and not to be violated without the greatest criminality. We know that parricides, those who kill parents or close relatives, as being the most detestable of all men, were formerly sewn up in a leathern sack and cast into the water. But God proceeds further when he commands all those to be exterminated who have laid violent hands on their parents or address them in abusive language. For to smite does not only mean to kill, but refers to any violence, although no wound may have been inflicted. If then anyone had struck his father or mother with his fist or with a stick, the punishment of such an act of madness was the same as for murder. And assuredly it is an abominable and monstrous thing for a son not to hesitate to assault those from whom he has received his life. Nor can it be but that impurity accorded to so foul a crime must straightway produce cruel barbarism. The second law avenges not only violence done to parents, but also abusive words, which soon proceed to grosser insults and atrocious contempt. Still, if anyone should have lightly let drop some slight reproach, as is often the case in a quarrel, this severe punishment was not to be inflicted upon such, all inconsiderate piece of impertinence. And the word, kalal, from which the participle used by Moses is derived, not only means to reproach, but also to curse, as well as to esteem lightly and to despise. Whilst, therefore, not every insult whereby the reverence due to parents was violated received the punishment of death, still God would have that impious pride which would subvert the first principles of nature held in abhorrence. But inasmuch as it might seem hard that a word, however unworthy of a dutiful son, should be the cause of death, this objection is met by what is added by God in Leviticus, quote, his blood shall be upon him, because he hath cursed his father or mother, end of quote, and as if he would put a stop to what men might otherwise presume to allege in mitigation of the severity of the punishment, end of quote. How to respond to parents who are too harsh? John Calvin. Should husbands and parents neglect their duty, should the latter be harsh and severe to the children whom they are enjoined not to provoke to anger, and by their severity harass them beyond measure? Should the former treat with the greatest contumely the wives whom they are enjoined to love and to spare as the weaker vessels? Would children be less bound in duty to their parents and wives to their husbands? They are made subject to the froward and undutiful. Nay, since the duty of all is not to look behind them, that is, not to inquire into the duties of one another, but to submit each to his own duty, This ought especially to be exemplified in the case of those who are placed under the power of others. Wherefore, if we are cruelly tormented by a savage, if we are rapaciously pillaged by an avaricious or luxurious, if we are neglected by a sluggish, if, in short, we are persecuted for righteousness' sake by an impious and sacrilegious prince, let us first call up the remembrance of our faults, which doubtless the Lord is chastising by such scourges. In this way, humility will curb our impatience. End of quote. We now move to chapter 18, the marriages of children. It is not lawful for children to contract marriage except with the consent of parents. Cultural norms either do good or evil to young people in preparing them to marry. Like our day, 16th century Europe was struggling under the weight of its unbiblical premarital practices. Since Calvin sought to bring all things in subjection to the Word of God, it was natural for him to apply Scripture to the premarital life. He concluded that marriage was extremely important and that there should be high priority placed on it while celibacy should be rejected. He chastised those who were immoderately extolling celibacy and who would convince people to despise marriage. He believed that marriage was a remedy for avoiding fornication and that it was not good for a man to be without a wife. He corrected the popular notion that a daughter could be forced into marriage against her consent. He prohibited marriages with unbelievers because it was contracting marriages with the wicked and contrary to Scripture. Calvin embraced the common duty of parents to help children get married. His view of parental authority was the guiding principle for his views of the premarital season of life, maintaining that it was not lawful for the children of a family to contract marriage except with the consent of parents. He expounded on good and bad reasons to marry. For example, he taught that it is wrong to marry someone out of mere physical lust, for marriage is a thing too sacred to allow that men should be induced to it by the lust of the eyes. He strongly counseled against decrepit old men marrying young ladies. He spoke against the Roman Catholic practice of childhood marriages and maintained that marriage is not legitimate except between those who have reached puberty. In his commentaries, he also maintained that true and valid engagements cannot be dissolved. And now Calvin speaks regarding the dangers and advantages of singleness. Quote, "Now, concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." 1 Corinthians 7:1. As he had spoken of fornication, he now appropriately proceeds to speak of marriage, which is the remedy for avoiding fornication. Now it appears that, notwithstanding the greatly scattered state of the Corinthian church, they still retained some respect for Paul, inasmuch as they consulted him on doubtful points. What their questions had been is uncertain, except in so far as we may gather them from his reply. This, however, is perfectly well known, that immediately after the first rise of the church, there crept into it, through Satan's artifice, a superstition of such a kind that a large proportion of them, through a foolish admiration of celibacy, despised the sacred connection of marriage. Nay, more, many regarded it with abhorrence, as a profane thing. This contagion had perhaps spread itself among the Corinthians also, or at least there were idly disposed spirits who, by immoderately extolling celibacy, endeavored to alienate the minds of the pious from marriage. At the same time, as the apostle treats of many other subjects, he intimates that he had been consulted on a variety of points. What is chiefly of importance is that we listen to his doctrine as to each of them. It is good for a man. Now, the answer consists of two parts. In the first, he teaches that it were good for everyone to abstain from connection with a woman, provided it was in his power to do so. In the second, he subjoins a correction to this effect, that as many cannot do this, in consequence of the weakness of their flesh, these persons must not neglect the remedy which they have in their power, as appointed for them by the Lord. Now we must observe what he means by the word good. when he declares that it is good to abstain from marriage, and that we may not conclude, on the other hand, that the marriage connection is therefore evil, a mistake which Jerome has fallen into, and not so much from ignorance, in my opinion, as from the heat of controversy. For though that great man was endowed with distinguished excellences, he labored at the same time under one serious defect, that when disputing, he allowed himself to be hurried away into great extravagancies, so that he did not keep within the bounds of truth. The inference, then, which he draws is this: it is good not to touch a woman, it is therefore wrong to do so. Paul, however, does not make use of the word good here in such a signification as to be opposed to what is evil or vicious, but simply points out what is expedient, on account of there being so many troubles, vexations, and anxieties that are incident to married persons. Besides, we must always keep in view the limitation which he subjoins. Nothing farther, therefore, can be elicited from Paul's words than this: that it is indeed expedient and profitable for a man not to be bound to a wife, provided he can do otherwise. Let us explain this by a comparison. Should anyone speak in this way: it were good for a man not to eat, or to drink, or to sleep, well, he would not thereby condemn eating or drinking or sleeping as the things that were wrong, but as the time that is devoted to these things is just so much taken from the soul, his meaning would be that we would be happier if we could be free from these hindrances and devote ourselves wholly to meditation on heavenly things. Hence, as there are in married life many impediments which keep a man entangled, it were on that account good not to be connected in marriage. End of quote. Is it best to be married or single? Again, John Calvin. But here another question presents itself, for these words of Paul have some appearance of inconsistency with the words of the Lord in Genesis 2:18, where he declares that it is not good for a man to be without a wife. What the Lord there pronounces to be evil, Paul here declares to be good. I answer that in so far as a wife is a help to her husband, so as to make his life happy, that is, in accordance with God's institution, for in the beginning God appointed it so, that the man without the woman was, as it were, but half a man, and felt himself destitute of special and necessary assistance, and the wife is, as it were, the completing of the man. Sin afterwards came in to corrupt that institution of God, for in place of so great a blessing there has been substituted a grievous punishment, so that marriage is the source and occasion of many miseries. Hence, whatever evil or inconvenience there is in marriage, that arises from the corruption of the divine institution. Now, although there are in the meantime some remains still existing of the original blessing, so that a single life is often much more unhappy than the married life, yet as married persons are involved in many inconveniences, it is with good reason that Paul teaches that it would be good for a man to abstain. In this way, there is no concealment of the troubles that are attendant upon marriage. And yet, in the meantime, there is no countenance given to those profane jests which are commonly in vogue with a few to bring it into discredit, such as the following: that a wife is a necessary evil, that a wife is one of the greatest evils. For such sayings as these have come from Satan's workshop, and have a direct tendency to brand with disgrace God's holy institution. End of quote. The common duty of parents. Quote, and Abraham said unto his eldest servant of his house, that ruled over all that he had, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh. Genesis 24:2. Abraham here fulfills the common duty of parents in laboring for and being solicitous about the choice of a wife for his son. But he looks somewhat further, for since God had separated him from the Canaanites by a sacred covenant, he justly fears lest Isaac, by joining himself in affinity with them, should shake off the yoke of God. Some suppose that the depraved morals of those nations were so displeasing to him that he conceived the marriage of his son must prove unhappy if he should take a wife from among them. But the special reason was, as I have stated, that he would not allow his own race to be mingled with that of the Canaanites. whom he knew to be already divinely appointed to destruction. Yea, since upon their overthrow he was to be put into possession of the land, he was commanded to treat them with distrust as perpetual enemies. And although he had dwelt in tranquillity among them for a time, yet he could not have a community of offspring with them, without confounding things which, and by the command of God, were to be kept distinct. Hence he wished both himself and his family to maintain this separation entire. End of quote. Unequally yoked. Calvin says, be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness, and what communion hath light with darkness? From 2 Corinthians 6:14. Many are of opinion that he speaks of marriage, but the context clearly shows that they are mistaken. The word that Paul makes use of means to be connected together in drawing the same yoke. It is a metaphor taken from oxen or horses, which require to walk at the same pace and to act together in the same work when fastened under one yoke. When therefore he prohibits us from having partnership with unbelievers in drawing the same yoke, he means simply this, that we should have no fellowship with them in their pollutions. For one sun shines upon us, and we eat of the same bread, we breathe the same air, and we cannot altogether refrain from intercourse with them. But Paul speaks of the yoke of impiety, that is, of participation in works, in which Christians cannot lawfully have fellowship. On this principle, marriage will also be prohibited, inasmuch as it is a snare by which both men and women are entangled into an agreement with impiety. But what I mean is simply this, that Paul's doctrine is of too general a nature to be restricted to marriage exclusively, for he is discoursing here as to the shunning of idolatry, on which account also we are prohibited from contracting marriages with the wicked. End of quote. On marrying idolaters, Calvin, as long as we live among unbelievers, we cannot escape those dealings with them which relate to the ordinary affairs of life. But if we approach nearer, so that a greater intimacy should arise, we open the door, as it were, to Satan. Such are alliances between kings and nations and for the ancient people. And although our condition nowadays is more free, still we are warned that all temptations are to be avoided which might give occasion to this evil. It's notorious that men are too apt to be led away by the blandishments of their wives, and also that men in their power compel their wives to obedience. Those, therefore, who mix with idolaters knowingly and willfully devote themselves to idols. End of quote. They have polluted holiness and married foreign wives. John Calvin says, some take Kodash for the sanctuary or the temple, others for the keeping of the law, but I prefer to apply the word to the covenant itself, and we might suitably take it in a collective sense, except the simpler meaning be more approved, that Judah polluted his separation. As to the prophet's object and the subject itself, he charges them here, I have no doubt, with profanation, because the Jews rendered themselves vile, though God had consecrated them to himself. And they had been polluted, their holiness had been polluted, even when they had been separated from the world, for they had disregarded so great an honor by which they might have been preeminent had they continued in their integrity. It may be also taken collectively, they have polluted holiness, that is, they have polluted that nation which has been separated from other nations. But as this exposition may seem hard and somewhat strained, I am inclined to think that what is here meant is that separation by which the Jews were known from other nations. But yet, what I have stated may serve to remove whatever obscurity there may be, and that this holiness ought to be referred to that gratuitous election by which God had adopted the Jews as his peculiar people is evidence from what the prophet says, that they married foreign wives. We then see the purpose of this passage, which is to show that the Jews were ungrateful to God because they mingled with heathen nations and knowingly and willfully cast aside that glory by which God had ordained them and adorned them by choosing them, as Moses says, to be to him a royal priesthood, Exodus 19:6. Holiness, we know, was much recommended to the Jews in order that they might not abandon themselves to any of the pollutions of the heathens. Hence, God had forbidden them under the law to take foreign wives, except they were first purified, as we find in Deuteronomy 21:11-12. If anyone wished to marry a captive, she was to have her head shaven, her nails pared, by which it was intimated that such women were impure and that their husbands would be contaminated, except they were first purified. End of quote. Now, marrying for the sake of beauty. Calvin. And Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve thee 7 years for Rachel, thy younger daughter. Genesis 29:18. Further, it is not altogether to be deemed a fault that Jacob was rather inclined to love Rachel, whether it was that Leah, on account of her tender eyes, was less beautiful, or that she was pleasing only by the comeliness of her eyes, while Rachel excelled her altogether in elegance of form. For we see how naturally a secret kind of affection produces mutual love. Only excess is to be guarded against, and so much the more diligently, because it is difficult so to restrain affections of this kind that they do not prevail to the stifling of reason. Therefore, he who shall be induced to choose a wife because of the elegance of her form will not necessarily sin, provided reason always maintains the ascendancy and holds the wantonness of passion in subjection. Yet perhaps Jacob sinned in being too self-indulgent when he desired Rachel, the younger sister, to be given to him, to the injury of the elder, and also while yielding to the desire of his own eyes, he undervalued the virtues of Leah. But this is a very culpable want of self-government when anyone chooses a wife only for the sake of her beauty, whereas excellence of disposition ought to be deemed of the first importance. But the strength and ardor of his attachment manifests itself in this, that he felt no weariness in the labor of 7 years, but chastity was also joined with it, so that he persevered during this long period with a patient and quiet mind in the midst of so many labors. And here again, the integrity and continence of that age is apparent, because though dwelling under the same roof and accustomed to familiar intercourse, Jacob yet conducted himself with modesty and abstained from all impropriety. Therefore, at the close of the appointed time, he said, Give me my wife, that I may go in unto her, by which he implies that she had been hitherto a pure virgin. End of quote. Choosing a wife for the elegance of her form. Again, Calvin. And Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve thee 7 years for Rachel, thy younger daughter. Genesis 29:18. Therefore, he who shall be induced to choose a wife because of the elegance of her form will not necessarily sin, provided reason always maintains the ascendancy and holds the wantonness of passion in subjection. Yet perhaps Jacob sinned in being too self-indulgent when he desired Rachel, the younger sister, to be given to him, to the injury of the elder. And while yielding to the desire of his own eyes, he undervalued the virtues of Leah. For this is a very culpable want of self-government when anyone chooses a wife only for the sake of her beauty, whereas excellence of disposition ought to be deemed of the first importance. This is the same text on a different subject. End of quote. Marriage is too sacred for the lust of the eyes. Calvin. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. Genesis 6:1-4. Moses does not deem it worthy of condemnation that regard was had to beauty in the choice of wives, but that mere lust reigned. For marriage is a thing too sacred to allow that men should be induced to it by the lust of the eyes. For this union is inseparable, comprising all the parts of life, as we have before seen that the woman was created to be a helper of the man. Therefore our appetite becomes brutal when we are so ravished with the charms of beauty that those things which are chief are not taken into the account. Moses more clearly describes the violent impetuosity of their lust when he says that they took wives of all that they chose, by which he signifies that the sons of God did not make their choice from those possessed of necessary endowments, but wandered without discrimination, rushing onward according to their lust. We're taught, however, in these words that temperance is to be used in holy wedlock, and that its profanation is no light crime before God. End of quote. Intermarrying in families. We quote, "None of you shall approach to any that is near of kin to him, to uncover their nakedness. I am the Lord." Leviticus 18:6. "None of you shall approach to any that is near." Now this name does not include all female relations. For cousin germans of the father's or mother's side are permitted to intermarry, but it must be restricted to the degrees which he proceeds to enumerate, and is merely a brief preface declaring that there are certain degrees of relationship which render marriages incestuous. We may therefore define these female relations of blood to be those which are spoken of immediately afterwards, namely, that a son should not marry his mother, nor a son-in-law his mother-in-law, nor a paternal or maternal uncle his niece, nor a grandfather his granddaughter, nor a brother his sister, nor a nephew his paternal or maternal aunt, or his uncle's wife, nor a father-in-law his daughter-in-law, nor a brother-in-law his brother's wife, nor a stepfather his stepdaughter. The Roman laws accord with the rule prescribed by God, as if their authors had learned from Moses what was decorous and agreeable to nature. The phrase which God uses frequently, to uncover the turpitude, is intended to awaken abhorrence, in order that the Israelites may beware more diligently of all incest. The Hebrew word, indeed, gnerbah, signifies nakedness. Therefore, some translated actively the nakedness of thy father, that is, the womb which thy father hath uncovered. But this meaning would not be suitable to the nakedness of thy daughter, or thy daughter-in-law, or thy sister. Consequently, there is no doubt but that Moses means to denote that it is a filthy and shameful thing. End of quote. Why did he refuse an opportunity for marriage? Calvin. "Nevertheless, in the midst of such commotions as these, I am so much at my ease as to have the audacity to think of taking a wife. A certain damsel of noble rank has been proposed to me, and with a fortune above my condition. Two considerations deterred me from that connection: because she did not understand our language, because I feared she might be too mindful of her family and education. Her brother, a very devout person, urged the connection, and on no other account than that, blinded by his affection to me, he neglected his own interests. His wife also, with a like partiality, contended as he did, so that I would have been prevailed upon to submit with a good grace, unless the Lord had otherwise appointed. When thereupon I replied that I could not engage myself unless the maiden would undertake that she would apply her mind to the learning of our language, she requested time for deliberation. Thereupon, without further parley, I sent my brother, with a certain respectable man, to escort hither another, who, if she answers her repute, will bring a dowry large enough without any money at all. Indeed, she is mightily commended by those who are acquainted with her. If it come to pass, as we may certainly hope will be the case, the marriage ceremony will not be delayed beyond the 10th of March. End of quote. A daughter's willing consent. Quoting from John Calvin, first the Scripture, "And Caleb said, He that smiteth Kirjath Sefer, taketh it, to him will I give Achsa, my daughter, to wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, took it, and he gave him Achsa, his daughter, to wife. Joshua 15, verses 16 and 17. Although it is the office of parents to settle their daughters in life, they are not permitted to exercise tyrannical power and assign them to whatever husbands they think fit without consulting them. For while all contracts ought to be voluntary, freedom ought to prevail, especially in marriage, that no one may pledge his faith against his will. But Caleb was probably influenced by the belief that his daughter would willingly give her consent, as she could not modestly reject such honorable terms. For the husband to be given her was no common man, but one who should excel all others in warlike prowess. It is quite possible, however, that Caleb, in the heat of battle, inconsiderately promised what it was not in his power to perform. It seems to me, however, that according to common law, the agreement implied the daughter's consent, and was only to take effect if it was obtained. God certainly heard the prayers of Caleb when he gave him a son-in-law exactly to his mind. For had the free choice been given him, there was none whom he would have preferred. End of quote. Breaking marriage engagements. John Calvin. True and valid engagements cannot be dissolved any more than consummated marriages, since God's commands also apply here. What God has joined together, let not man put asunder. They cannot be broken by mutual consent of both parties, far less by the will of either party, as once was tolerated by the Romans and even by Moses, because of the stubbornness of the Jews. End of quote. The seriousness of betrothal. Calvin. If a damsel that is a virgin be betrothed unto a husband, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, now that's from Deuteronomy 22:23. The severity of the punishment is now extended further, and a betrothed woman is counted as a wife, and this for a very good reason, because she has plighted her troth, and is a token of abandoned incontinency for the mind of a woman to be so alienated from the man to whom she is betrothed as to prostitute her virginity to another's embraces. But since one who has been ravished is not criminal, a woman is absolved if she be forced in a field, because it is probable that she yielded unwillingly, inasmuch as she was far from assistance. Although, however, the terms are accommodated to the comprehension of a rude people, it was the intention of God to distinguish force from consent. Thus, if a girl had been forced in a retired part of a building, from whence her cries could not be heard, God would undoubtedly have her acquitted, provided she could prove her innocence by satisfactory testimony and conjecture. End of quote. But if her father disallows her, actually the quote continues here, the expression is remarkable, "and the Lord shall forgive her," whereby Moses gently reproves the foolish thoughtlessness of the girl. And soon afterwards the same thing is spoken of married women. And surely their rashness is worthy of reprehension, if unmindful of their condition, they, as it were, shake off the yoke and hastily commit themselves. God therefore hints that they are not without blame, but lest they should be tormented by secret remorse, he removes every scruple, declaring that he will forgive, if the performance of the vow shall have been prevented in any other quarter. When the descent of the father or the husband is required on the same day, it is tantamount to saying that what they have once approved of cannot be disallowed. Further, to hold his peace to a wife or daughter signifies that he does not oppose, but give by silence a token of consent. Another quote from Calvin in this regard, so far as respects marital fidelity, from the time that a young woman was engaged to a man, she was regarded by the Jews to be his lawful wife. When a woman engaged to a husband was convicted of being unchaste, the law condemned both the guilty parties as adulterers. End of quote. Fathers held responsible for proofs of virginity. Calvin. If any man take a wife and go in unto her and hate her, again from Deuteronomy 22:13. This passage also tends to the exaltation of chastity. God provides against both cases, lest a husband should unjustly bring reproach upon a chaste and innocent young woman, and lest a young woman, having been defiled, should escape punishment if she pretended to be a virgin. A third object is also to be remarked, namely that parents were thus admonished to be more careful in watching over their children. This is indeed an act of gross brutality, that a husband, wittingly and willingly, should seek a false pretext for divorcing his wife by bringing reproach and infamy upon her. But since it does not infrequently happen that the libidinous become disgusted with their vices and then endeavor to rid themselves of them in every way, it was needful to correct this evil and to prescribe a method whereby the integrity of the woman should be safe from the calumnies of an ungodly and cruel husband, whilst it was also just to give relief to an honest man, lest he should be compelled to cherish in his bosom a harlot by whom he had been deceived. For it is a very bitter thing to ingenuous minds silently to endure so great an ignominy. An admirable precaution is here laid down, that is, that if a woman were accused by her husband, it was in the power of her parents to produce the tokens of chastity which should acquit her. But if they did not, that the husband should not be obliged against his will to keep her in his house after she had been defiled by another. It is plain from this passage that the tokens of virginity were taken on a cloth on the first night of marriage as future proofs of chastity. It is also probable that the cloth was laid up before witnesses as a pledge to be a sure defense for pure and modest young women, for it would have been giving too much scope to the parents if it had been believed simply on their evidence. But Moses speaks briefly as of a well-known custom. End of quote. As to children getting married, Calvin says, it has always been judged, and rightfully so, that marriage is not legitimate except between those who have reached puberty. When a boy marries a girl, this is a childish game and the sort of levity that deserve punishment. First of all, it must be stated that those who are under the authority of their parents or guardians are not free or independent, especially in this matter. Even if the parents or guardians consent, or even if they are the principal instigators of the marriage, nonetheless, the contracts made before the proper age do not bind the children unless, after they reach puberty, they fell the same way and voluntarily acknowledge that they consider their premature marriage to be valid. If any parents betroth their children before they reach puberty and pledge themselves and their possessions, they nevertheless cannot bind the children who are not yet ready for marriage. A contract of this sort is a profaning of marriage. If anyone has rashly put himself in a guilty position, let him bear the punishment he deserves. The terms of marriage cannot be carried out, since the children, when they reach puberty, are free to retract whatever their parents wrongfully contracted on their part. End of quote. Children who commit to marriage without parental consent. Again, Calvin. And Abraham said unto his eldest servant of his house that ruled over all that he had, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and I will make thee swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but thou shalt go unto my country and to my kindred, and take a wife unto my son Isaac. Genesis 24, verses 2 through 4. Now, this example should be taken by us as a common rule to show that it is not lawful for the children of a family to contract marriage, except with the consent of parents. And certainly, natural equity dictates that in a matter of such importance, children should depend upon the will of their parents. How detestable, therefore, is the barbarity of the Pope, who has dared to burst this sacred bond asunder. Wherefore, the wantonness of youths is to be restrained, that they may not rashly contract nuptials without consulting their fathers. End of quote. Old men marrying younger women. Again, we quote Calvin as before: if a decrepit old man falls in love with a young girl, it is because of his base and shameful lust. He will defraud her if he marries her. End of quote. A coerced vow to marry made null. Quote, dear sir and brothers, insofar as you have found it desirable to request our counsel and advice concerning the marriage vows between Monsieur Jean Foucard and Marguerite Hebricard, that is, whether their vows are valid, we, having assembled in the name of God, are in accord to offer the following. Having reviewed the acts and proceedings that we extracted from your registrar, concerning what Marguerite said, her mother and sister tell us quite flatly that the girl was deceived and that they forced her into it. Her aunt, the widow of Monsieur Pierre Foucard, as well as his brother-in-law and servant, have also sworn that they knew of this all along. Furthermore, there are three witnesses, of whom one, an Alexis Miot, solemnly swears that he was present when their vows were exchanged. A second, Simon Gaillard, says that when it came time for Marguerite to make her vows, he never heard her say the first word. The third, Monsieur Pierre Nemasseau, the royal notary, says that when it was Marguerite's turn to make her vows, he could tell by her countenance that what she was saying brought her no pleasure, and because he turned his back while she was crying, he heard her say none of the words one is accustomed to hearing. He also swears that since that day, whenever he addresses her by her married name, she always replies that this is not her name, as he well knows. Moreover, he has sworn under oath that he did not want to record this marriage, which he witnessed, since he knew that it was not of God, insofar as Marguerite had not consented to it. Hence we note that although a ceremony for the exchanging of marriage vows occurred, not a single witness swears that the girl said anything by way of consent. The second witness says that he is uncertain that she said anything. The third, whose testimony we can most trust, since he is a notary public and accountable for recording marriages, swears he saw no signs of agreement. Now, inasmuch as the girl cannot be expected to settle this matter, it remains to know who can. The notary public's testimony is amply sufficient. The aunt, the brother-in-law, and Pierre Havard's sister also constitute a valid witness. Above all, there is the mother's confession that she forced her daughter into it. Consequently, no foundation for marriage exists. Furthermore, Monsieur Jean Foucard himself affirms that he has not had an opportunity to speak to Marguerite for some time, that he has never understood what she actually said at their wedding. Therefore, given the present facts, we cannot rule that a marriage occurred. Rather, since the act took place contrary to order and reason, we judge it to be null. Nevertheless, since this is a delicate matter and could cause a great deal of conflict between the parties, and in order to forestall any unfortunate repercussions as well as to prevent future rumors and reproach, we are of the opinion that Monsieur Foucard should summon the mother and the girl before the common court and there have the marriage annulled. The two should solemnly swear and confirm what they have attested to be true. In any event, in our definitive judgment, their marriage vows are null, and each party is free to marry someone else. End of quote.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. an extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan hard drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan hard drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan hard drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan hard drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.